Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 112. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around the episode was recorded live at Continuum 13, the National Science Fiction Convention for 2017 here in Melbourne. And with me in this one are Narelle Harris, a writer friend of mine, and Paul Polton, a cosplayer, bon vivant, man about town, and media guy. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and then we'll start the live recording of the podcast from Continuum 13. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 112. My name is Terry Frost, and we are recording live at Continuum 13, the National Science Fiction Convention. All three members of the audience now clap. Rob had to put his coffee down. Okay. So with me, Paul Polton will be here in a minute because he got lost because the trail of breadcrumbs got eaten by birds.
He's around, I saw him.
He's around, we've had a chat with Paul. And with me also is the wonderful Narelle M. Harris.
Hello!
Yep, so Narelle, do the intro about all of your wonderful erotic Sherlock Holmes fiction and the rest of the stuff.
All my stuff.
All your stuff, all the things.
So, yes, I am Narelle M. Harris. I'm the writer of fiction across multiple genres, including fantasy, crime, horror, romance and erotic romance, very frequently in the same book. So yep. I have a new one coming out in August called Ravenfall with Clandestine Press, which is a gay paranormal romance thriller with sexy bits.
So you can get scared and turned on at the same time.
Exactly. So yeah, full of vampires and werewolves and hot sex.
Here's Mr. Paul. Yay! Sit down here and then you can do your bit.
Have we started already?
Yeah, pull over a little bit because the mic's there. Okay. And we're doing a bit of propinquity to make it work. See, I used a big word.
You did. That's impressive.
Get in context.
You wrote it down in front of you in like breaking the syllables.
Okay, Paul, so who are you and what have you been doing, my friend?
Hi, I'm Paul. What have I been doing? Watching a lot of television, probably not watching enough movies.
You can never watch enough movies.
Well, this is true.
Yeah.
And going back and watching some old stuff that I've seen bits of, but never sat down and watched the full thing from start to finish. So
it can be so educational doing
it. It can.
It fills in the gaps and you go, yes, but that new thing did it wrong, your bastards and all that.
Yeah, well, like this year so far, I've actually watched Casablanca from start to finish, which I'd never watched before.
Yep.
It's awesome, isn't it?
Did you see the remake?
Well, who would bother with the remake?
There is a remake of Casablanca.
There is one.
Barbed Wire, starring Pamela Anderson, is an actual remake of Casablanca.
Sadly, yes, I have seen it.
I shit you not.
I have seen it.
Now I want to.
And the original Boris Karloff Mummy.
Yep, cool. Yeah, as opposed to the one with Tom Cruise, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. So we probably should do, what a shit that Adam West died.
That is sad.
Adam West didn't take himself too seriously, had a new career as a cult kind of thing. Mayor of Quahog, which means Quahog has to do an election.
Yes.
I like him. He was on my Facebook and he'd do things like show the turkey he cooked for Thanksgiving and just do the fun stuff. And it is a shame that he died. Everybody, I suppose, except me will do it. But it's a shame and nice
guy.
Yeah, I'm not dying. Interesting shit keeps happening, pal.
My mother keeps telling me she's not going to die, but yeah.
I mean, you keep feeding her with those potions. But yeah, did like Adam West. He was in a movie I've talked about previously on the podcast, Robinson Crusoe in Mars. Got killed early. Monkey lived longer than him. But yeah.
Poor Adam. Poor one Adam. Of my the memes that I saw coming across on Facebook the day that he died was, do you know the old quite a regular meme that's used of Batman slapping Robin and telling him off for being an anti-vaxxer or whatever? And it was just where Batman was had been blanked out, and it was just Robin going, "Batman, Batman!" It was like, oh, this is the first time that picture made me sad.
There was the other one too, where Batman's slapping Trump, and he says, "One final slap."
Hey.
So yeah, I like Adam West a lot.
But yeah, like I had such fondness, of course, growing up with the original Batman TV series and all the fun of that. Now Robin. That Robin was my first TV crush.
My first TV crush was Batgirl, because Batgirl had that like purple leotard really tight. And because Yvonne Craig was a dancer,
she moved beautifully.
Caliente, I mean.
Yeah.
Eartha Kitt too.
Let's face it. I mean, what was it? 86, 88?
What?
Adam West?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a good innings. That's
pretty good. You know, but he always just seemed to have enjoyed his life and not kind of resent this idea that he was typecast as this particular...
He did go through some rough patches in the 70s and the 80s, and he did have a slight alcohol problem. But he got his shit together and reinvented himself and became beloved by people again. Who'd almost forgotten him. And, you know, all credit to the man.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll move on to the next bit because we've only got an hour this time. I promised 2 hours next time, people, but we've only got an hour this time. The Black Panther trailer dropped.
I've only seen it once so far. But
Black Panther trailer, I mean, I'm welded on Black Panther and Marvel, and Wakanda looks fantastic.
Yes.
Mm.
I love the fact that it's 90% black cast.
Yeah. It's like, because there's so many things, it's like, I see white people.
Yeah, except for the Hobbit and Gollum.
Yes.
It's a black guy. And it really does look, it's good within the Marvel realm, but it's got a different look in the same way Guardians of the Galaxy's got a different look.
Mm.
It's very much, well, you can't really say third world because Wakanda's the most advanced civilization on the planet. But it's got very much a non-Anglophone and non-white
culture. Yeah, like a really strong, vibrant culture that's non-European.
Yeah.
So it just looks fantastic.
And people like Stephen Barnes on Facebook, who's a fantastic writer of colour, and he saw the trailer and loved it. And I always kind of use him as a way of checking my white bias.
Mm-hmm.
In these things, and and you get other people going, well, do we really need to make it? Yeah, we fucking needed to make it. we need to make it all.
I do wonder if Andy Serkis has got some sort of a contractual clause
with his South African accent.
Well, I was thinking more that some part of him must be CGI rendered.
We never see his actual face, do we?
Well, I mean, you see his face in this one, but he's missing an arm, and I'm thinking, I'm pretty sure he hasn't cut the arm off just for the movie.
Well, let's just say there's a reason Andy Serkis hasn't done nudity. But Black Panther trailer looks great. I'm sure there are going to be a couple more Thor Ragnarok trailers dropping soon, because that's how Marvel does it. They spoon-feed you until you want more.
Yes.
So I'm looking forward
And the first one of those was pretty much okay, let's have some more of that thing.
Yeah, and they've done... One thing Marvel does that DC hasn't quite got the knack of yet is balancing the light with the heavy.
Mm.
And that's not an easy skill when you've got that much shit to balance.
I'm in hopes that DC... Well, I mean, it's only one movie, but I'm hoping that... After seeing Wonder Woman, that DC may have actually found a sense of humour somewhere.
Yeah, because the actual comics DC reader for ages. I still read some of the titles, but it just, like, the first Batman film came out when The Dark Knight, or not long after The Dark Knight, had been such a huge hit, and it seems to have dictated the tone of every film. Since then, they seem to not know how to not do it that way.
Absolutely.
And it's a shame, because, you know, you just need to take one of the comic books. You already have a storyboard, people. Justice League, particularly one of the 80s Justice Leagues might be, 80s, early 90s.
I know that you're a DC comic fan because you sold my wife, Sally, 88 Wonder Woman comic books at this convention.
Yes.
And we've got to schlep them home.
Yeah.
And then I've got to kind of go, can I read that? And she'll say no.
She was to charge you 50 cents so she can make some of her money back.
Too damn bad.
I'll have to sneak it in while she's sleeping.
I will freely admit that my comic book reading is very, very limited. I think I read X-Men stuff during the 80s and 90s, and that was pretty much it. Most of my DC knowledge comes either via pop culture osmosis or television, TV series and things like that. So, you know, all my Superman has come from the TV series and the movies. All my Wonder Woman has come from the TV series and the old Super Friends cartoon. Right.
Yeah.
so, you know, I don't know how accurate it is to the comic books, but as a movie, and I mean, you know, as somebody said, being the best DC comic book movie is not really a high bar.
Yeah.
So, but you know, yeah, it certainly gives.
I haven't actually seen the Wonder Woman film yet. I've been because I have been very busy, and I was going to go this weekend, but of course we had a competition.
Good choice though. Good
and
choice.
I have instructions from my husband that I'm not allowed to trot off in the middle of the day and see by myself. He wants to see it with me, so we have to wait till we both got time again.
Yeah, I'm actually reading my comics on this, the tablet, because it's just a convenient delivery system for me.
Yeah. Oh, and comics.
Can you get a big enough Mylar bag for that, though?
Yes, you can. I'm actually getting a keyboard for it. But, yeah, I really like it because if I'm not in the mood to read a book on the Kindle, I've got this in my bag as well. So when I'm commuting, I can just knock through some comics and have a bit of fun with it. But, yeah, I mean, do you think Wonder Woman will save DC?
Well, it kind of depends on whether or not they're paying attention to why it's successful.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It could, but not just DC. It could be, I enjoy a lot of action films, but a lot of action films also really deeply annoy me. And particularly since Mad Max Fury Road came out, it's like, people, please notice that there's more than just teenage boys who like action films, and there are older people who have, you know, of the female persuasion, who have disposable income, which they're really happy to buy, not just that, but all the merch.
Yes.
Like, we're desperate for something that actually really appeals and speaks to our hearts, and we want to spend the money.
Would you like my Wonder Woman, was it the pop vinyl doll thing?
I totally would.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, done. There you go. Done. We're doing deals here on the panel. But yeah, I mean, Sal's already done that. There's a $60 Wonder Woman book based on the movie that she bought from Justin, who sells books at the convention for the people listening. And it's beautiful. The detail's beautiful. And at the back, it's got a plastic photographic cell of that picture of them all during World War One. So you can stick that up on a wall or on a light box and have it there as a display thing. It's just a beautifully done piece of thing.
Yeah, I've been looking at the book going, you know, because the visuals of the movie. One of the things I did love is that, you know, Wonder Woman has so long been sort of not quite the female version of Captain America, but similarly tied up in that whole jingoistic, rah-rah Wonder Woman.
It's interesting,
But they've ditched the stars off, the blue...
Stars and bars,
The stars and bars off the costume, and it's still the same colour, but she's very much now a foreigner in the country.
I'm assuming they've redone the origin slightly. What happened... okay, I'll get my head sorted out, but I'm not having seen it. I'm very much hoping that, at least in some of its tone, the film will reflect the way George Perez reinvigorated Wonder Woman in the 80s when they did the reboot, because there was a whole bunch of reboots done then, including Superman. And Perez's comic was just full of these really great female characters. And when you say strong female characters, it doesn't mean they were all warriors. There was an academic, there was a woman who was in PR, but like they were just... I'm starting to dislike the term strong female character and wanted to go more subtly for the fully rounded, very human female character, because they're so often we don't even make it as far as two dimensions a lot of the time.
And also...
And it's really frustrating. So people, when they think of Wonder Woman, I think they often still think of the Linda Carter series or the older comic books.
And the male gaze.
And the male gaze. Yeah. But there's... I hope to talk about this a little bit later too, but I've finished reading a couple of months ago a book called The Secret History of Wonder Woman by Jill Lepore, if you're looking for that, Lepore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually about how she was created originally by this guy who was... William Marsden, who was a psychiatrist. He's actually the guy who invented the lie detector, which is what the lasso was all about.
Originally, it was a glowing rope, but they found that people would use it to tie things up.
Yeah.
So there's a movie coming out about him.
Oh, excellent. Yep. Looking forward to that. So he actually wrote it.
Yes.
He wrote it because he thought that women were the future. He wrote her as this strong feminist character, yeah, which then the comic, and he was it was in poly relationships. He was a fascinating guy and like very, shall we say, complicated.
Yes,
but
yes.
You know, there was these really strong positive drives behind, plus a little bit of an obsession with bondage. But she was very much, you know, not about the man's world, it was like the women's world, and encouraging girls and women, and you know, they had bits of the comic book which were about, you know, great women from history and stuff like that. And then the DC head bods at the time got kind of scared and started watering it down and making her want to make tea for Steve, which was, but then, you know, so she's waxed and waned since her creation, but her creation was very steeped in being a feminist character and a way for the future and for as a role model for young girls and for women to see that they could be break out of the roles that society at that time had defined for them. So to
society
see her back there now,
it.
It's like it's a full circle thing. It's not a new idea. It's going back to the original idea.
Yeah, Gal Gadot, well, I won't spoil it, but she does a fantastic job.
Yeah.
She looks great in the role too.
And the thing, without going too much into it, because I know you haven't seen it, well, the thing that surprised me and I liked a lot was the fact that they didn't do disservice to World War One and the meat grinder that it was.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of interesting, and it's a hard thing to do in that format of a film because you've got to do the big action scenes and the, you know, the, all of the things that are expected. Yet, they did it right because my mother had an uncle who got hit by one of the big bombs and disintegrated. They never found a body. Up in the Dardanelles, it wasn't Dardanelles, sorry, somewhere around Villers Bretonneux.
And even the villain, although, you know, again, she's almost fallen back to a two-dimensional you know, female villain. Again, they've used, you know, she's got the sort of that
half mask
prosthetic thing that was quite far too common after World War One. That, you know, people who've had facial injuries. Prior to, you know, any sort of cosmetic reconstruction surgery that was available, you know, had these sort of weird masks.
There wasn't a society around in the 20th century. I don't know if it's still there, but it's called the Society of Smash Mugs. It's about people who went to war, male or female, and got disfigured, and they started like a pen pal relationship network among these guys as a mutual support thing. Well, the Australian Prime Minister was disfigured during World War II, John Gorton. Mm. And the plastic surgery, he had that thing where they had to attach the skin of your shoulder to your face for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, I've seen photographs of that. There was some, certainly I've seen it online in the last couple of years, that photographs have been released of the amazing work that was done given the medical technology of the time. Yeah. And it's, you know, pre-antibiotics.
Absolutely.
And stuff as well.
It was,
and,
it was
you
just
know,
so delicate.
The work they did
trying
to reconstruct people's, you know, jaws and the horrific injuries.
Mm.
Yeah,
using ribs to replace jaws and things like that. It was a non-trivial task to a totally different level. But, the other cool thing I like about Wonder Woman is Warner Brothers didn't have enough faith in it because they didn't do an agreement with Patty Jenkins, the director, to possibly direct a second film, which is a standard thing for these big franchises. James Gunn, I know, did it. What they do is they say, yep, we'll pay you to make the first movie, but we want an option on you making the second film, so we'll chuck extra bucks at you. And it's a way for them to lowball getting the same person for the second movie. It was random, you know, wildly successful. They didn't do that with Patty Jenkins because they didn't have enough faith in Wonder Woman. It would have only cost them a couple of million. Instead, she gets to negotiate fresh to make the second Wonder Woman movie.
I sincerely hope
they do bring her back to make it.
And it's going to cost them tens of millions of dollars.
Good.
Because her sensibility is what made it work.
Yeah.
Even people as stupid as studio executives, who are usually ex-PR agents and accountants, realise the importance of that and getting her on board. So, yeah, she's buying a bigger house at some stage. In fact, several. But I really like the fact for them to kind of underestimate the power of this franchise and the skill at which Patty Jenkins made the movie.
Because it remains to be seen that despite the obvious success of the film, both critical and, I believe, financial, whether or not they'll actually believe that it's not just a freak one-off and that the people who've loved that film and are paying to see it multiple times and are buying all the merchandise will do it a second time.
I think that what they'll do is they'll crunch the numbers on the merch, crunch the numbers on the views. It'll go boku when it does streaming and disc sales. I mean, just in my household alone, we've spent hundreds on the merch. But, yeah, I want to see more of this kind of thing. But one of the things that was said on our sister podcast, Galactic Suburbia, last night was people are criticising Wonder Woman for not being feminist enough and not having all those things. And Alyssa said something really marvellous, which was, it's the first one, it can't do all the things.
Yes.
But you need to have a first one that does some of the things.
Yeah, and the thing I've started to refer to as well as people being the new Puritans, where like you're not pure enough.
Mm.
And aren't perfectly pure in whatever their personal vision is of the absolute purity of your leftiness or whatever, then you are obviously heinous and the work of the devil.
Yep.
And it's just an argument, a game of I'm more pure than you are, and it's just the new Puritanism.
Yeah. But that's the thing, a better world isn't a destination, it's a direction.
Yeah.
And even in genre film, a better world, which is more inclusive of a lot of people, Black Panther, Wonder Woman, all the other things that are going to come up that we're going to all love and enjoy, hopefully, it isn't like get to there. It's move from here in the direction of there. And I think that if you remember that, even if there's a misstep along the way, you know that it's heading in that way.
And there's also there's a harshness, I think, of... like, everyone should be at the same point at the same time. You know, I'm 52 now, so there's still a lot of...
So youthful.
Thank you. It's the lack of children.
Yes, and monkey glands.
Keeps me wrinkle-free.
And the monkey glands.
And the monkey glands. Yeah. But there's this sense of, like, so the things that I was taught by my family and by society when I was a young girl and a teenager in my 20s, they're like, I've been unlearning so much. I've been learning huge amounts, but unlearning stuff all my life. I expect to continue to discover new things and to be open to new things. The key is to be open to learning and to think there's so much that I don't know. And you come across things going, oh, I always thought such and such was the case, or I never thought about it. Now I've opened up to, and I'll read across things to try and get multiple views of a situation. But, you know, we can't all be...
Yeah. I'm so much luckier than you. I had such an abusive childhood, it was easy to go against it. when they love you and they look after you, the bullshit sticks better. But for
it's
me...
It's moulded on.
Yeah,
yeah,
for me
have
it's
a
like...
Hug. Have a hug from Mattel.
Thank you, darling. I'll get this first hug I've had on a podcast. I'm going to do more of that shit.
doesn't work well on radio, though.
I'll give you a hug.
You've got to make an R sound so it, you know, carries for the people.
Yep. Wonder Woman, I'm optimistic about it. We saw a gold class cell went squee a lot. She's got the Barbie doll with Godot. So she's got them for
everything. Awesome.
And I was on a panel the other day, and while I was on the panel, I bought her a Wonder Woman headband.
Nice.
On eBay. Nice.
I was going to say, one thing I am getting sick of, maybe not quite to the disgusted with, but just more annoyed with, every time we bring in a new character, we've got to have another friggin' origin movie. I mean, we're up to...
Have a flashback, for fuck's sake.
I was going to say, we're up to, what are we, 4 or 5 number Spider-Man that's due out?
Three Spider-Men.
I know, yes, sometimes you need to have the origin story of how they got together, but it's like if we ever go down the track of the Black Widow movie that people have been saying, well, you know, they've finally done a Wonder Woman movie, can we have a Black Widow movie? Don't do a goddamn origin story.
Well, we kind of know already, but there's this sense that I'm always thinking, like, I don't stop every person I meet anew in my life. So before we go any further, please tell me the entire story of how you became the person that you are.
Yes.
Things unfold with time, and sometimes you can have key moments, and I think they make a mistake in starting with the origin story all the time. I think you could slice back flashes flashbacks and stuff into it.
Necessary.
I think there are more creative ways of... giving the hint, but a lot of the time you're going, like, we know how Batman got to be Batman, like it's so steeped in pop culture. You could just do a couple of, you know, 10-second flashback moments throughout the film when they're relevant to whatever's going on, if you're going to bother at all. But like, you only really need it in the first film. But I think there's too much of a... I think they underestimate the capacity for the audience to not care how we got there, we've just got a hero, and to only look at those moments when they become relevant to what's happening in the storyline.
You can flip that too, which is, somebody's got wonderful powers, and as things move on, we slowly get fed little bits and pieces of how they got those powers. You don't have to make it like, you don't have to front dump the origin.
Mm.
You've got other ways of telling those stories, which television has done very well in various ways, with people who are extraordinary in various ways. So you can really do it that way. And one of the problems with doing those origin stories is a certain amount of the audience will come to expect that. And they'll say, that's how superheroes are, you do the origin story first. And I want diverse storytelling in my superhero.
But that's it's always, you've spent 2.5 hours on the prologue for the next film, essentially.
How many times have we seen those pearls from Batman's mum hitting the dirt?
Yeah, well, that's what I said. You know, how many times, I mean, even in Batman versus Superman, there was a back montage of, you know, him being hauled out of the well.
And why does Batman never get his shit together? He can get the best psychiatrist in the world, and yet he lives within the trauma all the time.
Because he likes his fucked up head.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Which is one of the things Netflix universe.
I was going to say, just speaking of origin stories, I am so glad that they didn't go with one of the original concept ideas for Wonder Woman, which was because...
Pom-pom girl?
No. Apparently some Pratt decided that, well, because she's supposed to be able to kick Superman's ass, therefore, the only way that we can do that is to make her a secret Kryptonian.
You can't see, but I'm face-palming like the devil at the moment.
That's the Star Wars problem. Everybody in the universe is related to each other.
Yeah.
Man, that's such an incestuous place.
It is, absolutely.
It's terrible.
But,
don't they know anything about Superman's history with magic? I mean, seriously, no.
So we move on from Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
The Mummy's just dropped, the movie The Mummy.
Literally.
Yeah, it's not doing well.
I was just reading some reviews. 32 million for the opening weekend.
Look at the iconography of the posters to start with. The Mummy's in the background and Tom Cruise looking heroic in the foreground. It doesn't say Tom Cruise on the fucking title. It says The Mummy. But Tom Cruise, being that Scientologist who believes that he's a super thetan superhero in real life...
Hey, don't knock the clam.
I will.
I'm sorry, I'm just always thinking about...
He's got a self-image of being more than human.
Yeah.
And because he's a producer on these things and because he has a lot of clout in the industry, the movie's become about him, not about his character, because his characters are usually lightly written. Even Jack Reacher, who's a great character in the books, becomes Tom Cruise. Rather than Tom Cruise becoming
and
Jack
Reacher.
And,
you know, that works when you're Sean Connery.
Sean Connery's only ever Sean Connery. Yeah.
I must admit, I can't help, whenever I think of Tom Cruise, there was a British comedy sketch series called Star Stories, and I know from that the reason Tom Cruise is still in Scientology is that John Travolta regularly hits him in the back of the head with a shovel to keep him...
Well, he may
to keep
hit
him dazed and easily persuaded.
He may hit him from behind with something. I'm not sure there's a shovel. But, the whole thing's about Tom Cruise, which is a mistake because you're starting what they call the Dark Universe franchise. And the interesting thing was, when Marvel started, they didn't make a movie about Robert Downey Jr. They made a movie about Tony Stark and cracked it open a little bit in the post-credit sequence. But what they didn't do was make it about the actor.
Well, we all know RDJ is Tony Stark.
Well, yes.
Or very much I would like to be.
I think the talk about, you know, lightning striking, being able to get lightning in a bottle with RDJ for Iron Man, you know.
One of my favourite things of his is when he brought that prosthetic for the prosthetic limb for that kid.
Yeah.
And he's kind of pretty much just showing up as Tony Stark saying, here, this is what my team developed for you, kid.
Yeah. But that's good. That's actually a charitable act.
Yeah, it was lovely.
But, the Mummy, the whole iconography is about Tom Cruise. I like Tom Cruise movies for the action. I don't like Tom Cruise in them. I've got this really mad dissonance about it, which is I like the movies, but why the fuck is Tom Cruise in it? Even though he's supposed to be the propeller.
I've liked him in some. I actually quite like Vanilla Sky.
Yeah.
And I thought he was in...
No, you've got to see A Breeze Low Ojos, which is the original Spanish version, which is much better. But, Tom Cruise, it's like he made Born on the 4th of July, and he's been running ever since to make up for being in a wheelchair.
Even in The Firm, he was doing that whole...
Someone check on the bastard's ankles.
He runs. That's his thing.
Yeah, with his little legs going.
Yeah. And the look of concentration on the face.
I want to see Tom Cruise in a remake Wizard of Oz as a munchkin. Because he's a short little bugger.
But
James Bond told us. Short people in the world cause all the trouble.
Oh, what?
Oh, I thought it was short people got no reason,
That's the one.
I've seen a James Bond novel that short people cause all the problems because... Goldfinger, because Goldfinger was 5'2". But yeah, see, and there's an argument for that.
So anyway, ignoring Tom Cruise for the moment.
Yep.
So this is supposedly the start of the...
Dark Universe.
So we've got... I was reading a review earlier, and unintentional typos, you've got to love it. Supposedly, one of the new movies coming out is The Bride of Frankenstein.
That's like a sequel.
Frankenstein strikes out in a whole new career as an architect. Yes. Oh,
no,
Frankie!
No, it's not. It's like Frankenstein in the Bridges of Madison County.
Oh, no.
Him romancing Meryl Streep.
So we've done The Mummy. We're supposedly doing Frankenstein. God knows we need another remake of Dracula.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Because Rusty's in there.
Russell Crowe's supposedly Dr. Jekyll. I heard rumours that they're trying to bring Phantom of the Opera into it.
Yeah, because everyone loves opera.
Yeah, well, you know.
That's what you need, a guy in a mask singing Ness and Dorma.
Or, you know, some mothers do have them with a mask.
See, one of the things that, like, I'm intrigued to see what comes out, but one of the things I'm always thinking about, how much of this is still going to have all its origins in how Buffy was done, because the Buffy influences across all the DC TV I'm using. I'm kind of tired of seeing kind of the Buffy framework. Like, surely there are other ways to tell stories about people with powers.
One of the problems I've got with Dark Universe
is... I don't know if they're going to do that.
For a start, the Brendan Fraser the Mummy movies weren't that good.
They were enormous fun, but they were not good.
But they weren't necessarily good. And people are getting this crazy, like 20 years after, nostalgia about them. But they
I mean, the first one, I think, was a good movie.
I've got another point to make. The Mummy is a horror franchise innately. It's not an action franchise innately. The Brendan Fraser movies made it an action franchise, but the essential story is pretty fucking horrible. Yeah, mummifying people while they're alive and then their spirits live on and they reanimate. That's a horror franchise. They're making it into an action franchise.
Mm.
It's like if you did Fast and the Furious in gothic mansions.
But
it doesn't
work. Mummies are sort of... Unless you can find some way to redo... Again, it's like vampires. Vampires used to be scary. Vampires have now become something you take home and you bring home and tell your mother about and say, oh, look, I've got a vampire. They're not scary
anymore.
And then
he slaughters your whole family.
And unless you can think up some way to come at it from a different way or...
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have a whole talk of it, but the vampire metaphor, what the vampire stands for, has altered fairly regularly over the last 150 years. And currently it's representing is not the frightening other, but how we have othered, you know, non-whites or you know, vampires became frightening again in when HIV and AIDS was a huge thing. Yes. So blood became frightening again. But now we're going, but we spent all that time othering, you know, the queer community or, you know... Yeah. So then we started to bring vampires kind of back into the fold because we realised that, you know... So that metaphor... And it doesn't always quite work because in the end the vampire does want to kill you. So it wasn't actually a perfect metaphor to be playing with.
Do we need
new
monsters for new times?
Mm.
Because I'm thinking of things like The Handmaid's Tale, which is a monstrous horror story. I won't watch it because it'll trigger me.
Mm.
But we need new monsters reflecting the fears and the actual perils of modern times, and maybe that's something that
a lot of them are social.
So,
you're saying
we need is a giant orange radioactive something with a triple.
No, not that simplistic, because what we need is we need to find out what scares us now.
What's scary is the social oppression of various things, and having your
and you've got to find a metaphor that
ability
that
to now one of the reasons I think zombies were so popular for a while is they're partly that kind of metaphor that you lose.
Yeah.
Your own volition, you're absorbed into the mass, either literally or figuratively, by being eaten or becoming one. But a zombie also is reflective of, I felt, of partly of the our fear of loss of self through the fact that we have longer lifespans now, which means that dementia and Alzheimer's and all that sort of thing, is actually affecting more of the population, and that's a loss of self. It also represents partly like the madness of overconsumption and things like that, where everyone just becomes a mindless consumer. So that's where the horror of zombies came in. Then people started obviously wanting to play with that, so you get more playful ideas or things from the zombies' perspective and things.
I'm going to tip that on the head with the Alzheimer's thing, because my mum has dementia. And the weirdest and the most counterintuitive and the most wonderful thing about it is she's happier than she's ever been in her life. Mm-hmm. All of the things that in her past, and there were some monstrous things there, are forgotten. And she's living in the moment, and she's doing the things. She does get confused and cranky about it, but overall she's happier than she's ever been in her life. Mm. And that's such a kind way to drop
that
out.
Is. See, my father's not having that experience. He knows. Yeah. That I'm sort of. It's horrible to say. That I'm hoping that he'll get to that point where he no longer knows that he's not himself. That it's going to be, you know, the flowers for Algernon pre.
Yeah.
You know, because the tragedy of that story is that he loses. You know, Algernon loses all that gift that he had and
that
knows that he did. So
what that demonstrates is, it ain't just one thing.
Yeah.
There are whole different stories. There are a million stories.
Multiple interpretations. Okay. Yeah.
And that's and you know, I suppose again, just in general with movies, we are fixated on brand recognition at the moment, and until we can ditch that, you know, we're going to have sequels, remakes.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just
the thing is, the movies that delight me most, and they're usually serious films, or at least, you know, like non-genre works, are the ones where I can't pick what's going to happen. The ones that come out of left field, the ones that show me something I haven't seen or get me to see things in a way I haven't looked at things before. And it's a hard ask, but it's the job of art to do that in some ways.
Yeah, there's some good TV shows doing. I just finished watching the 6 episodes of The Aliens, British series. Which
my favourite at the moment is still American Gods, which has a hard-on dick pic in an episode shown twice. And it's an important plot point. It leads the main character to where they need to go. And in 21st century social media context, it's the most efficient and striking and confronting way of getting to that point. And I like that. I like the fact that they stepped out of the comfort zone of you know, the old way they would have done it was him getting the phone, flicking through the dick pic, and you'd never see it. But we see it at the moment he sees it, so we have the same reaction he has. And I like that. I like the way that particularly streaming services don't have the same chains to shackle them as network television and even HBO to a certain extent. They're a lot freer and they can tell stories in ways that are grown up. You don't have to cater everything to 14-year-olds with Christian parents. And I really like that, and I think that
that
storytelling will become more adult.
That can make for a whole other podcast, I think.
Oh, yeah, we'll have to do it. But, yeah, so moving on to franchises, we're still doing franchises, which is the theme of the podcast. Kong Skull Island, Godzilla, Monarch Universe.
Yeah. I saw Kong Skull Island. I decided I'd go and see it.
I got my Planet of the Apes shirt on, don't
you? I decided I'd go and see it at the cinema to get, you know, full effect.
Yeah.
And actually watched it in 3D.
I think Kong Skull Island is Tom Hiddleston's rehearsal for James Bond. Because you know that I could be a suave, tough character, even though I'm a comfortable middle class boy who happens to be good actor
with a degree in the classics.
Yeah, yeah. I love it when people try to play tough when they're not innately tough. It's always amusing. It's like, oh, aren't you cute? You're so cute.
Look at him trying to play tough. Yes. I don't know. I mean, the last Godzilla movie we had, when was that?
2014, was it? Somewhere around
there. Yeah, it's only fairly recent. That wasn't bad.
Were you talking about the Japanese one? Japanese
the,
one.
Not the Broderick one. No,
not the Broderick one. There was an American one as well.
Yeah, well, that was the...
Yeah. But the latest Japanese Godzilla movie, as our friend Rob Hood sitting in the front row will tell us, kicked ass.
Mm.
I mean, having all those bullet trains rocketing a Godzilla full of explosives was a great moment. And you think, fuck yeah. And Godzilla's powers being manifest when he's attacked is pretty spectacular in that movie. Shin Godzilla, that's what it was. Yeah.
It was a design that was completely different from all previous ones.
And much larger.
Yeah. perhaps. Well, they have been getting larger. That's because cities have been getting higher.
Yeah.
But
maybe a three-story Godzilla just barreling through buildings.
Yeah, I was going to say the bloke in the rubber suit, you know, slowly mowing through the average 10-story skyscraper. Just now Godzilla's sort of
now it's mocap because Shin Godzilla was mocap motion capture, and it worked for me. I was on board with the whole lot, and it did that thing of showing us things we hadn't seen before. And using the environment as a way, as one of the characters almost. Tokyo is one of the characters in that movie.
Mm. And it found a way of making its own metaphor for the whole thing.
Absolutely.
That's why there were so many committees in it.
Yeah.
The film is
there was a lot of
political. Come to a decision on how to deal with this. And of course, they just talk themselves around in circles.
Yeah.
Nothing happens.
There's a lot of political satire in Japanese politics in that, which I didn't fully understand, but I recognised that it was that.
Yeah.
But the Godzilla Monarch universe, they hinted at things like Mothra. If they don't put the peanuts in there, I'm going to be disappointed.
The peanuts?
Did the little girl sing Mothra?
That's the only thing I remember about the Mothra films from the beginning.
What you do is
my brother's impersonating the peanut girls.
Now you get Miley Cyrus and you get Katy Perry to be the peanuts. I think they're singing the Mothra song while wearing Hawaiian fancy dress.
The post credit sequence in Kong.
Hints at King Godzilla.
Godzilla, Mothra. There was.
Ghidorah was definitely there.
What's the three headed?
Oh, Rodan.
Rodan.
Yeah.
So
great sculptor for a monster.
Yeah. I don't know. It's the.
I want to see Bob.
It's one of those things that that we've tried to do, I suppose, Western versions of it. None of them have been particularly successful.
The Japanese loved the last Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
They loved it. Whereas the previous one, the American one,
Roland Emmerich,
nothing but contempt for it, as was shown in the first Godzilla movie they made after that, where the real Godzilla turns up, just blows the hell out of this, and their one in an instant.
Yeah, but Shin Godzilla, I don't think that the Monarch universe, which is what I'm calling it, had anything as wow as the stuff that was in Shin Godzilla.
Yeah, no, it was, and I mean, even visually, it was sort of, after seeing it on the big screen, I think I could have gone, I could have waited till DVD. There wasn't anything
The coolest thing.
And the CG.
Kong Skull Island had moments like when they're walking through the bamboo forest. I mean, that worked. That just popped.
Yeah.
I have to say, for a lot of it, had great moments. For me. Yeah. I loved it. I mean, as a giant monster fan from way back.
Yeah. You're well
done. It was a sort of giant monster film, aside from the Godzilla ones, that are actually more serious than the rest.
Yeah.
And
making it a period piece.
That one wasn't overly serious. It didn't have any underlying.
Just don't let Peter Jackson near it.
Yeah, and I don't think Samuel L. Jackson's character worked at all.
No.
I think the motivation was pretty fucking dumb. But, I mean, there were moments I liked. I didn't mind Kong as, like, guardian of the world from the subterranean monsters, which were pretty nasty and gnarly. And the other thing I liked about it, which is purely a technical thing, is the way they made the size and heft of them feel real. Like Godzilla throwing the great big monster against a cliff. And having that impact, it kind of worked. They've got to the stage where the physics of the CG is adding verisimilitude to what we're seeing.
I really must get around to seeing this. The last King Kong thing I saw was King Kong the Musical when they had it on stage in Melbourne, which was the strangest thing I've seen in a really long time.
Which was purely there to show their animatronic skills.
The puppetry was the best bit. It was fascinating. Everything else was so odd because like every scene, every set was fantastic, but every set was actually from a completely different play, which they mushed together in the one. It was so odd.
Maybe they should merge franchises with the stage and have like puppetry of the giant penis.
It might work.
You would go and see that, Narelle.
You know, I probably would. But it just reminds me in the stage play when they got to Kong Island, the way they introduced the islanders, and again trying to possibly move away from that whole unfortunate colonialism, racist way of depicting them. So they all kind of, the dancers all were coming across the top, and they all shimmied down these tubes on stage. So it was like they were being kind of pooed out. And they were just all just in weird colours, and like they basically were aliens pooed out into the stage through these long narrow tubes and then dancing for a bit. It was like, oh, when's the ape coming back? I like Kong.
But Kong Skull Island did the natives right, I think, because they had their own culture, their own society. And even though they did have that wonderful Ben Gunn type character played by John C. Reilly, their culture was of their own, and it was kind of respected in a weird way. They didn't do the usual, you know, blackface with bones in your hair kind of stuff, and that kind of worked for me. But, I'm coming at a different angle for this next bit, because there was a panel here at Continuum 13 about whitewashing characters, and they had people of various Asian ethnicities on the panel, so we got a viewpoint that was purely non-Anglo. And I had a little bit of an epiphany while I was watching that, because I was there to learn and to listen. And I learned a lot of things about how that whitewashing affects people from all parts of Asia. And I thought, there's something that I saw in a movie not long ago that made me feel a little bit of what they're feeling, which is the Australians in Pacific Rim, who were played by English people and Americans. And I thought, yeah, that pissed me off. Anytime an American or an English person tries to play an Australian, it pisses me off. Imagine if that happened every time.
Some of the worst Australian accents in Hollywood.
Yeah, but imagine if that happened every time an Australian was on screen. That's a little bit of what people were...
You are giving me a whole flashback to the 70s and 80s whenever an Australian character, and the rare appearance that they made, would speak with a Cockney accent.
And that bullshit in The Simpsons even.
The bad Cockney accent.
Was still, in a sense... Mm. Cultural appropriation.
That was one of the reasons that I loved Space 1999. He was one of the few noticeably Australian.
Yeah, Nick Tate.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, I mean. And the fact that I had to reach so far and so wide to understand that shows how much of it there is.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to kind of put that out there, because for me it was interesting, and I'm going to be watching cinema where Asian characters appear a lot more closely in future.
And I think also, I mean, I didn't see the panel, so I don't know if that was touched on. But one of the things that I remember was the whole whitewashing thing that was brought out. And there were two films that I was thinking of as far as that goes. One was Gods of Egypt, which I think, yes, that was a legitimate criticism.
On the other hand, the director was Egyptian.
Yeah, but Great Wall, on the other hand, there was a huge amount of whitewashing accusations thrown at that.
Yeah.
And then once you actually saw the movie, you go, oh, okay, maybe that wasn't a legitimate
It's interesting because this whole thing about, you know, representation, I'm actually really bored with a lot of the white people I see in films, partly because... even when it's not, you know, fantasy or whatever, but I'm an overweight woman and I'm an overweight geek, right? The white characters I'm meant to identify with really don't have much to do with my life anyway. So I'm kind of interested in seeing wider experiences. So over the last month, we've watched on Netflix, we watched Dear White People. Mm. We'd just seen Moonlight, which is such a beautifully made film. And then we went to see Get Out, which we had the same reaction as friends of ours who we like, you know and follow on Twitter and stuff, who like Benjamin Law came out and just with his friend was just going, they're everywhere, just these scary white people. So I want wider experiences. I don't want just white faces. That's not the life that I live. I don't have just white friends, you know, and I want to see greater representation and better representation.
My mate Albert, who I work with, is from Zimbabwe. He's not white. He got scared as fuck watching Get Out.
It's a great film, by the way.
He came in and said, have you seen it? That's really scary shit. And I said, yeah, mate, for you it is. But, his reaction was viscerally scared by it, which is good, and because it's partly comedy, partly serious.
Actually, one of the things this is probably for another podcast, but they open it beautifully with the old trope of a woman walking alone down a dark street being stalked by a car, but it's a black man walking down a dark suburb, very leafy, walled suburb. And then this car pulls up behind him, and he's just, he doesn't want trouble, he's trying to avoid it. Yeah. So they immediately put him in a role that in a horror film we're used to associating with a vulnerable female, and they immediately have you on his side.
Good.
What happens next is so, it's really well crafted, and it's mostly really creepy, except the massive violence in the last 10 minutes. It's so cathartic, it's great.
And okay, then it's now time for giveaways, because I have a whole bunch of stuff I got in boxes.
Bags of goodies.
Okay,
stuff.
Okay, anybody know Norse mythology or read Neil Gaiman's Norse mythology?
I haven't read his
Who is the mother of Sleipnir, Odin's eight-legged horse?
Loki.
Yes, you win a prize. Okay, you got a choice. So, Elaine, who is a Patreon supporter of the podcast, and we love her for that, gets a choice. You can have an alien with Yaphet Kotto, or you can have a Captain Marvel figure. Okay, there we go. So that's the start of it.
That lady Captain Marvel.
Let me see.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Is anybody here?
We'll take what we get.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you an extra prize because I'm getting rid of some. Some Firefly socks.
Sweet.
I'm good to you just like you're good to us.
Yay.
Okay, is anybody here scared of clowns?
No.
There's a clown. Sal, you got a clown. Okay, here we go.
Is that actually Pennywise?
Yes, it is Pennywise.
Yeah.
I'm going to give this to Narelle because I love her. It's a little book called Rimworld Magazine's Women with Guts.
Oh.
So you got that. Paul, I've got to find something for you, mate.
Oh, look, there's Ripley.
Ho, 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 you've been a good boy.
Thanks.
You have a Blu-ray player or not?
Thanks, Andy, Trevor. On my computer, yes.
Name's not Trevor.
You haven't got
a Blu-ray player. Okay. Have you? Yes or no?
On the computer.
You got Body Melt.
Body Melt.
The Australian movie, which has got lots of, you know Body Melt, Rob.
Of course.
Have you got a copy of it?
No.
There's the DVD version.
Sorry, I'll stop to read my magazine.
Yeah, okay, you stop to read your magazine. Let's see, there's other stuff here as well. Anybody watch Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul?
Sorry, I thought you said Bacon Bad.
You get the Saul Goodman figure.
Nicely caught. Well done. Well thrown.
Natural athlete.
Yes.
Natural fucking athlete. Okay, so we've got other stuff here. Every kid wins a prize. I've got to find something for Roman. The Man from Hong Kong video.
Oh, yeah,
I've got it on blue now.
Too.
Yep. Australian exploitation. Anybody seen the Assault on Precinct 13 John Carpenter movie?
Yes.
You seen it?
Mm.
Who hasn't seen it?
The John Carpenter movie?
Yeah.
The recent one?
No. The new one?
The new one?
Yeah. No, so the old one. The old one.
I was going to say, no, it's not on Precinct.
It's the old one.
That's 90. What is it? Early?
This is 80s.
80s, yeah. I was going to say.
Who wants it? Is the question.
You know you want.
I've already got it.
So. You've already got everything, mate. Okay, Sally gets it. The other Sally gets it. Okay, how about He-Man action figure glow in the dark? Who wants? Okay, there we go. Sorry, what was your name? Who?
That's it. It's no longer mint in box.
No, but it was delivered airmail. Anybody seen Goldstone, the Australian action film with Aaron Pedersen in it?
Which one?
Goldstone.
Never even heard of it.
Mystery Rod and Goldstone. Ivan Sent.
I don't have a Blu-ray player, so this is no good.
No, well, you're not having it then.
No, but I wanted to see who was in it.
Aaron Pedersen.
Rude. Yes, and? Oh, Jackie Weaver, David Wenham.
Yep.
David Goldblum.
Who's got a Blu-ray player and likes good action films?
Ching Pei Pei.
You haven't got that one? Get Mystery Road as well. It's a prequel to that. Okay. But
Mystery Road was excellent.
Sequel to Mystery Road.
No, never seen that.
But yeah, I recommend that highly.
That is fantastic.
I'm not doing that Pirates of Caribbean. Who collects those things?
Yeah.
It's a Pirates of Caribbean. There we go. That. Our friend Paul got that. Van Helsing. Who wants a copy of Van Helsing on DVD? I'm leaving that on a table because I don't fucking want it. First Australian vampire film from the 1980s.
Oh, I remember.
Okay, there we go. Sally gets that one. This is interesting for the people listening, of course.
The only reason that I went and saw Van Helsing was because Kate Beckinsale was in it.
Yeah. Oh,
and, of course it. Of course.
And she made you feel funny in your boy
part. I went for Hugh Jackman.
Okay. So we've still got the Alien Nostromo collection figure.
Does it have a chest buster in it?
No. It's got like little Chan figure aliens with Yaphet Kotto as well.
Yeah, I'm just sort of thinking for those playing at home, we should just read some of the headings of this magazine. Okay. Get away from her, you
Dragon Ball Z, perfect cell, pop vinyl. You could be mysterious seeming.
What's a perfect cell?
Perfect cell, CEL.
Yeah.
From Dragon Ball Z.
Dragon Ball Z.
Is it Z or Z?
Z.
Z, because it's American, isn't it?
You want it?
I thought it was Japanese.
There you go. Enjoy.
As you may know, I don't. May have noticed, I don't watch it. So.
No, well, no.
An invisible Bilbo Baggins. Pop vinyl. It's see-through.
The
Who
box
wants
is
that?
Empty.
Who wants that?
Yeah. I remember seeing the Invisible Man.
Do you want it? No way? No?
I'm just going to have a look at him.
There you go. You can have it. I just saw you eyeing it off. You can have it. Let's see how we're doing for time.
Santa's sack is now empty. As
we've still got 7 minutes to kill. So what are people looking forward to that's coming out? So we're on to the moving forward.
What's coming up?
For Ragnarok, I'm kind of hanging out for.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I love the New Zealand director.
Taika Waititi.
Yeah. So I'm really hoping there's a bit of bit of that.
Did you notice I didn't make a joke when I said his surname?
Yeah, but you had to point it out.
But
though,
you had to point out.
His name's Taika Waititi.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, he did What We Do in the Shadows, which was fantastic, but he did the Hunt for the Wilder People, which was so good.
Yeah, I mean, putting
the
human...
I think they let him have his way with this movie.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing they've learned from James Gunn is you get a director with a distinctive style, you give him a loose leash. And I think that really does kind of work for him.
Yeah. I think that whole Marvel Universe thing, you know, it's still... In spite of... Some movies not being as good as others. Yeah. They haven't launched a turkey yet.
No.
So it's still a juggernaut that's just.
I did see all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies rated. My friend Rebecca McLaren, who I do the radio with in Darwin, sent me the list on Facebook because we always do the Marvel movies as they come out.
Do you count the Fantastic Four?
No. We're talking about all of the canon. Marvel Cinematic Universe movies.
Yeah, and Fantastic Four is owned by Fox. That's not Marvel.
We both disagree.
It's not the Marvel Universe.
No, it's not.
No, it's not.
It's not part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But
so you remove the crappy bits.
We disagreed enormously with the list. And I said, well, you know, I'd rearrange that list significantly. But that's the problem with these kind of lists of best to worst. There's nothing more subjective in movie reviewing than doing a list. Because, I mean, for me... If I was doing science fiction movies in a list, all science fiction movies, the Star Wars movies would be down the bottom, but a lot of other people would...
Yeah, but you're a sook.
No, but a lot of other people would be out with pitchforks and forks.
Absolutely.
Torches about that.
And I'll be one of them.
Because it's subjective, and it's okay for me to be subjective about that. I'm not going any further than that. The thing I am looking forward to, which is science fictional, but isn't quite a movie. I play a console game called Destiny, which is set in a science fiction future. And Destiny 2's coming out. And you get to play the
Destiny's
Child. No, they shouldn't. Destiny 2 has got new settings in the solar system. They've got settings in the methane oceans on Titan, where you get to fight on that. And the cinematics and the world building of that is better than I've seen in a science fiction movie. It's fantastic. They've got these sea platforms with 40-meter waves on a methane ocean. And it looks fantastic. They're doing Io, so you get to kind of play the game amidst sulfur volcanoes. And the world building is terrific. The mythology of it's terrific. It's storytelling, but by another means, and over which the person who's the consumer has some control about how the story plays.
And let's face it, with any video game, you've got far more time to take than, you know, the usual 2 hours that you've got for a movie, so you can afford to spend the time on.
And in a lot of ways, it's more immersive because you're controlling what's happening with the action. And you know, even though it's not cinema, I think it is storytelling, and it's a way of telling science fiction stories that's new and different. And it's not for everybody because you know some people don't have the time or the resources to do that.
I don't have the time. I know I've got the genie. So if I knew it, I wouldn't get out of the thing again. So I just...
I kind of have that too because I play it way too much where I should be reviewing movies for things and I should be doing other stuff and I should be doing the cat litter and all of that kind of thing.
I'm still playing Fallout 4, so, you know.
No, for me it really works because I'm looking forward to it and I like the universe and I like the fact that our story's being told to me but I'm part of the story.
No, I think a couple of movies that I'm looking forward to... I'm looking forward to see what there's a new movie coming up about the train, the Orient Express, and Ken Brenner's mustache.
Yeah.
Murder in the Orient Express. Oh, I saw the clip to that.
I'm so tempted to do a spoiler on that. How was the mustache?
Rob knows what I'm talking about.
So yeah. I'm curious to see what they're going to do with that, because there was a remake of that.
Poirot was bald.
The Poirot version of that managed to make it quite fresh.
Yeah.
But the TV series, David Suchet.
Yeah.
The story I know so well, and is often, you know, it's where they trot all the retiring actors to do a last film before they die. And the Suchet version actually managed to refresh it by making it very much a struggle that Poirot has about what is justice there. And I enjoy Kenneth Branagh, but I'm not.
Oh, look, I love Ken Branagh, but yeah, I'm sort of going,
yeah,
all right.
Yeah, I won't be paying money to see that.
It's worth seeing the original movie of it too, because apart from having people like Sean Connery in there, Albert Finney playing Poirot, and Lauren Bacall, and
the cast on this one is looking pretty impressive.
But the most impressive thing is in the cast. It's Richard Rodney Bennett's soundtrack, which, you know, he does orchestral works, and his soundtrack for that is marvellously good. So we're probably going to have to wind this up, guys.
I was just going to say, the film I'm looking forward to is the new Kingsman film.
Colin Firth fan.
And I'm waiting because I'm pretty sure Colin Firth has something in his contract that every film he must be wet.
Yeah.
Because he's had a wet shirt at some point in most of his roles.
Sure, half of the audience is going to be.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Okay. Anyway. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for being part of this, everybody in the audience as well, and the panel, Narelle M. Harris, Paul Cole.
Thank you, Jerry.
That's okay. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I will drop the credits in at the end of this. And that's a wrap.
Yeah, so that was the one we did live at Continuum 13. I will drop the credits in. I did actually talk to one of the Careys, who is a Patreon subscriber, and he wants to be known as Best Boy. That's his credit title. So I'm going to play the credits now. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In next week, or even sooner, with another Paleo Cinema podcast. Thank you for listening. Look after yourselves. Keep watching the skies. Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers, and here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller; Sarah, our special effects technician; Ian, our caterer; Grant, our technicolor consultant; Claire, our script doctor; Gary, our prop master; Morris, our music director; Jan, our dialect coach; Armin, our key grip; Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler; Elaine, our scientific advisor; Julia, our casting director; Chris, our camera operator; Christopher, our gaffer; Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress; Tansy, the foley artist; Alyssa, the location scout; Mark, our second unit director; Paul, our special makeup effects director; Tammy, our donut wrangler; Tim, our New York unit director; Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor; Steve, our script doctor; Dylan, our goat wrangler; Eric, our set security lead; Carey, our second script doctor; Richard, our set photographer; and our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.